Welcome to the 33rd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as Wimbledon gets underway, we'd still rather be watching Matt Prior than Maria Sharapova.
And who wouldn't with the Australians rolling into town? I'm actually quite excited by the prospect of a sort of standalone one day series.
You're one of the few people who are.
I am one of the few. And that's not to say that I wouldn't rather be watching an Ashes series. Of course I would. But it's actually quite nice and quite unusual to have a one day series that can stand on its own merits, that isn't just a warm up to a test series, or even worse, and what we see all the time with Ashes series and one days after them, is this massive sense of deflation after
sort of
the series.
After the Lord Mayor's show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think it kind of, so it allows the one days to sort of speak for themselves. And I think it's kind of going to allow both sides to experiment a little more. The players aren't really paranoid about having to sort of prove their case for.
I think the timing's really interesting because you've got an Australia team that's in actually quite a short period of time has sorted itself out, and you've got an England team that under Alistair Cook is actually, you know, progressing in its own way. I just feel that the problem that all one day series to me seem to have is just that lack of context. They don't. Yep. It's not clear what they're connecting to, what they're building to.
But by when you have them next to a test series, the only context you have is a test series, which isn't really much context to a one day series.
No, I'm not even sure what the solution is. But
no, just don't play one day cricket. Maybe
just don't play one day.
But it's quite interesting that the way that it'll prepare England for the South Africa series, actually, because Australia with their quicks, young set of really, really quicks. And similarly, one of the big challenges the English batsmen are going to face against South Africa is obviously the Philander
Stain. A few of their sort of surprises, aren't they? And particularly with someone like Pat Cummins, who you'd almost like to save him up for an Ashes series. And England are going to get, you know, going to get a bit of exposure to him.
So you haven't been getting excited about the one.
Well, I've been getting excited about the series that probably nearly every other cricket fan in the world managed to ignore, the tri-series in Harare, where Zimbabwe, Bangladesh and South Africa.
Someone has too much time on their hands.
Well,
on the,
you know what?
On the back
I very
page of Cricket Info.
This series, but it was actually quite an intriguing little affair. Everyone beat everyone at one point, which was interesting. South Africa beat Bangladesh, Bangladesh beat South Africa, Zimbabwe beat South Africa, etc., etc. And the most significant thing is Zimbabwe won, which I've always had a soft spot for Zimbabwe. And for all that cricket in that country has gone through, they seem to have assembled a side of real, genuine talent. And particularly impressive in the final, they inflicted a 9-wicket defeat over a South Africa team that admittedly was missing a couple of key names, no de Villiers, no Smith, but it's really impressive. The real star of the show, Hamilton Mazakadze, who any genuine cricket nerd out there would know, the youngest ever test centurion, just 17 and something something days.
Is that right?
When he made his test 100.
There
you go. Gone a little bit quiet, but he was quite outstanding.
Now, how old is he now? 57?
Now 27 years of age, but quite outstanding at the top of the order. Made several 50s during this little tri series, and you just feel like Zimbabwe might be a handy little side come the World 2020s this winter.
It's interesting that the South African side wasn't. It was weaker, as you say, but it wasn't massively weakened. But actually, you'd expect any of the what we think of as the sort of top rank of test nations, India, England, Australia, to be able to lose two or three players and still from their first choice team and still to be able to beat Zimbabwe, or at least not to lose by such a huge margin.
No, it was a very strong margin. I think particularly some South African bowlers got a real awakening. You know, they took a real beating, actually. Nicest of all, perhaps, to see was the fact that looking at some of the photos afterwards, you had a full ground in Harare, you know, fancy. And it's wonderful that the game is still in some sort of health there. So that was certainly a positive of the last few weeks.
Yeah, it was. But another thing, I mean, Zimbabwe, we always talk about them as is this the new dawn of Zimbabwean cricket? And that always keeps on coming around. And they're your West Indies, but there's another thing that keeps on coming around at the moment, which is spot fixing. And we sort of think that we've seen its extent, and then something else comes up. And Dennis Kanaria being sentenced for leading astray, for being a misleader of youth when it came to Mervyn Westfield. In a sense, it's not really news. It's just another player who's come out as being part of spot fixing. But I think what is one of the things that is quite scary that is emerging is the fact that when it was all sort of confined to Pakistan almost, and it was sort of said that there was a culture there, and it was because they weren't being paid enough, etc., etc. But the fact that within county cricket it's not isolated, but there does seem to be a bit more of a a web going on.
It was quite scary how slick the operation seemed to be.
Yeah.
I mean, Canaria knew people. He very quickly sought Westfield out as someone who... I mean, I can't remember the exact quote, but the idea was he pretty much said to Westfield, look, it's hard to make money as a county cricketer, you know, along those lines. And Westfield, there was something very depressing about that. But I guess at the same time, something encouraging, the fact that he's now been banned, you know, he's now been caught.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably... We should pass mention of poor Tom Maynard as well, the tragedy of his death last week.
Story that we've never, that I still don't feel we quite fully understand. But I mean, I was brought back to last summer where I was fortunate enough to watch Maynard bat at Whitgift for Surrey. You know, it's been said by many other people, but what an extraordinary talent! And I think there's just something unbelievably. Something painful when you know, cricketers, you know, any young sportsman, the prime of their career, and there's just this incredible sense of waste. And I think what was particularly moving was the way it seemed to really affect the entire county game. You know, there was real sort of stronger ramifications throughout the whole game.
So, from the archives, in this episode, Andy is going to introduce us to the four different breeds of the true number 11.
It's almost an endangered species now, the true number 11. I mean, in Duncan Fletcher's era of the 360-degree cricketer, everyone's got to chip in. And the genuine number 11, the sort of bowler who looks deeply awkward with batsman in hand, doesn't really... Well, they do exist, but they are becoming rarer and rarer. I've kind of sort of had a look, you know, through the archives and seen some of the many different types, many different breeds that we've encountered. And I thought we'd start with the destroyer. Now, this number 11 sees batting as very much an act of violence. They're normally kind of a brawny pace bowler, kind of muscular, sort of tall guy, very much intent on swinging. You know, from the moment they go out there, defence is kind of not in any way acceptable. Great entertainment for the crowd, but usually in very short doses. I thought Steve Harmison's actually not a bad example of this in his own way. I remember most recently, you know, he never looked to hang around... tall guy, would always swing his arms, look to hit a few boundaries.
Another one, Simon Jones. I remember a few innings against the... you're saying Steve Harmison reminded me. A few innings against the Australians in 2005. But also, I think we've seen an example very recently of that, even though I'm probably breaking across your categories.
Maybe
he fits better into another category. But Tino Best and his innings there, it wasn't short-lived. That was the difference, because I know exactly what you mean about these batsmen. There's absolutely no attempt to protect their wicket whatsoever, and they will just have a go at absolutely everything.
I was going to say, Tino Best, really, this whole feature is being done in honour of Tino Best.
No.
He kind of provoked me to sort of think about this as an issue, because, you know, the highest ever score by a Test number 11 batsman. But I think it would be unfair to put Best in this category, because really, he didn't play like a true number 11 at all. I mean, Best played some great shots. I think the definitive destroyer, who I only got a chance to see a little bit of in kind of my very young cricket-following career, was Devon Malcolm, who really... there was apparently a lot of people at the time who felt Malcolm genuinely had a problem, almost like a biological problem, seeing the ball. He actually really couldn't see the ball. I mean, he did, after all, wear glasses, actually. So he had real issues. But he would swing at everything. And, you know, very powerful, very strong guys would show the ball. An average of 6 runs is testament to the fact that it very rarely came off. But there were some wonderful moments. I mean, the particularly Shane Warne bowling to him and Malcolm hitting him for these two vast sixes. I mean, really huge sixes. And when you are perhaps the greatest spinner that's ever bowled, that's a fairly sort of demoralising.
I suppose one thing that lends itself to this kind of attitude in the number 11 is the fact that they've got absolutely nothing to lose. It's at the end of the innings. Runs that come off the last wicket are seen very much as a bonus. No one ever expects.
Particularly if you're Devon Malcolm playing in an England side heading for yet another inevitable Ashes defeat.
And no one really, I mean, unless it's at the death and you have to bat out half an hour in fading light to save the Ashes or to win the Ashes, no one's actually going to actually really want you to hang around just defending and leaving. They're, you know, having a go is the way to do it.
They do, and they have a freedom, you're right, that very few other batsmen enjoyed. So from the destroyer, we move to perhaps the exact sort of the opposite category, which is the terrified. This type of number 11 doesn't enjoy batting at all. It's really an ordeal that they have to go through. He's not excited about contributing those few extra runs, definitely doesn't see it as a bit of fun. And actually, the example that came to me for this was Phil Tufnell, who I heard on the radio a few weeks ago talking about how the night before facing some of the West Indian pace bowlers, he couldn't sleep. You know, this wasn't something, this wasn't a minor concern. This was really traumatic for him. There are some great images of Tufnell. He would put every bit of padding equipment that he could find on before going out to bat. And I suppose the fear to an extent is understandable. He clearly was not equipped to deal with.
I remember, I don't know if I do remember, but I have this idea in the back of my head of watching cricket in the mid-90s. So I was pretty young. I was younger than 10. And seeing Alan Mullally bat. And I swear that he was batting against against Australia. And the umpires had to tell the bowlers that they weren't allowed to bowl bouncers at him simply because it was just known that he just would have absolutely no ability to get out of the way of it at all.
Well, there is this rather generous provision within cricket's rules to protect batsmen of that ilk. You know, in theory, that provision is there. But I think, you know, in Tufnell's case, the sheer pace, and I mean, perhaps it's unfair to single Tufnell out. We've all seen plenty of number 11s that have gone out to the crease looking very unimpressed by the prospect. Yeah. And it's funny because the point's been made by others much more eloquently, but there's no equivalent with batsmen. Batsmen don't have to then go out and carry out a skill that they're not equipped to do in a very difficult environment. It's rather unfair.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've gone from the destroyers and the terrified to the defiant. And these are really the heroes, the people who we kind of remember in the folklore. Number 11s, these number 11s arrive with the team in really desperate straits, but they go out there and pull off something special. They save the game. Actually, the name here might be a bit of a surprise, but the one that actually came to mind here was Graham Onions, who there is a real argument to be made.
Well, is this a South Africa series, are you thinking, in South Africa?
There's a real argument to be made that Graham Onions, over the course of a couple of weeks, saved that series for England. Some number 11s will go their entire career without ever being in a position to save a team. Onions was there twice in just 3 weeks.
It's always really interesting, actually, when you... when you're supporting a team that's trying to bowl another side out, so you're supporting the bowling side, and there's always, I always get the sense that actually it's the number 11 batsmen which are somehow, sometimes more difficult to dislodge than the openers, and they just manage just to get their bat down in time on everything. And there's a kind of a really shambolic defensive technique, but somehow they just manage to get the bat on absolutely everything, and that's kind of what Onions did.
Well, Onions had the first test and the third test. He found himself at the crease having to save the draw for England. Pulled it off on both occasions. I particularly remember in the first test, he found himself dumped on strike for the final over, which was not particularly clever. Mm. And Ntini was bowling. And I think it's kind of true what you're saying, that Ntini wasn't quite sure how to go about it and actually ended up not making Onions play enough. And it was interesting. Mm. But it was really quite a courageous performance from Onions because his composure and calm was there. And frankly... It's very easy to envisage a scenario where he failed on both occasions and South Africa won that series 3-1. And, you know, it's not saying too much to say that kind of result could have shifted a lot of the dynamic of England's recent progress.
Do you think that he played like that because it is in his... I, off the top of my head, don't know enough about... I don't have the image of enough of Graham Onion's batting performances.
No, I don't think there's been enough out there. I don't think there's enough mental footage out there.
Do you think that's because that's how he was as a batsman, or simply that's because what the situation asked of him? And if he had gone in with England 580 for 9 in the first innings, in fact, he would have just thrashed about.
It's a really curious one. I think it says it's very much a mental thing, isn't it? I think different people approach that situation in very, very different ways. I mean, I was fascinated as well when West Indies, it's a much forgotten series, when West Indies beat England 1-0 a few years ago in the West Indies, Fidel Edwards did this to England as well. And anyone who's watched Fidel Edwards bat, the guy is a very bad batsman. I mean, he really is. But he just showed he just showed a willingness, and perhaps that's it. It's just you find yourself in that position, and instead of exhibiting fear, you think, this is my chance to be a hero, an improbable hero.
That must have been spring 2008 or something.
And it was. And it, you, in a way, the combination of ineptitude and bravery makes it all the more heroic.
Yep.
So, on the subject of ineptitude, we reach our final category, and perhaps the category that's closest to everyone's heart, and these are the truly inept. These are the number 11s who, despite being obviously talented sportsmen, despite having played a lot of cricket, despite inevitably having spent quite a lot of time in the net, just can't do it. You know, holding a bat is an issue, a basic forward defensive shot. Many candidates for this, I think, from our generation of sort of cricket watching, Chris Martin of New Zealand is very, very hard to beat. A total of 98 test innings he's now had, and averages 2.4, which
it is spectacular. It's
really
absolutely
quite
spectacular. Particularly as a number 11, you're going to get quite a lot of not outs as well.
And he has, in fact. He's had about 40-odd not outs. Yeah. And you would surely think that a basic forward defence was teachable. I suppose what's quite intriguing is the extent to which is Martin genuinely useless at batting, or is he maybe perhaps indifferent to it? I'm not sure.
There's a very, you showed me earlier, a very amusing video on YouTube.
Chris Martin's Learn to Bat video.
Learn to Bat video,
which he's gone along with quite contentedly.
It's actually very, very witty.
But there's a sort of serious point to it that actually, I quite enjoy the Crick Info page that describes him, his Crick Info profile that describes him as outrageously inept. I like the idea that you can be outrageously inept. But it makes the point as well that actually Chris Martin's career has been quite seriously harmed by it. I mean, coaches are less and less willing to pick players like that, particularly for one day and limited overs games.
You always expect people to contribute something all the way down the order, I suppose. Mm.
So that is kind of, I'd like to feel the full array of the number 11. And I guess what I would like to say is that I hope in years to come there will still be a role for this within the game, because it's certainly provided some memorable moments over the years. To the book review, and this episode we're looking at Rain Men by Marcus Berkman. Berkman, a comic writer who's written sort of a variety of books and has made a particular niche in sort of writing about kind of the village level of cricket. It's a book that there are an awful lot of cricket books that kind of look nostalgically and whimsically about the joys of village cricket. This book's a slightly grimmer affair in that it's a study of obsession, really, isn't it? And that there's an Ian Hislop quote on the front that talks about a very funny book about some very sad men. And it's about, I guess, the obsession of village cricket and, the sort of difficulties that come with that.
It takes the life of a cricket fan over a summer. Basically, it's as the basis of his narrative. And it talks about not only playing cricket as a village cricketer, but watching cricket and even a bit of writing about cricket. And one of the things I found it lacks occasionally was a bit of a sense of narrative. We reviewed 6 months ago, something like that, Harry Thompson's book, When Penguins Stop Play, which is absolutely hilarious. And made us both cry at the end.
And the connection of the two being that Thompson and Berkman were members of the same
side. Exactly. And it does overlap. But the thing about When Penguins Stop Play is that there's a very clear narrative that runs through it all, which is that they all go on a world tour. Mm. Whereas for this, there isn't really, and it dots around quite a lot. And I found that quite distracting, actually. But where it works is that it's able to kind of draw links between the international game and the village game in quite an interesting and a satisfying way, as well as coming up with some actually very, as well as being very funny, some very, very insightful things.
You're right that the structure, even though there is this kind of, in theory, this structure of going through the year, it's quite a kind of bumbling affair. But there are certainly moments, and I guess perhaps why it's... You would have to love cricket, I guess, to read this book. But perhaps more generally, it is a study of obsession. I mean, he talks about staying up through the night to listen to an Ashes game. Yeah. He talks about particularly Harry Thompson, in fact, the fact that he has been present for 365 games, you know, despite
it's actually quite terrifying.
And what's interesting is he's showing this obsession, almost showing it in its full kind of sadness, frankly.
Yep, yep.
But you're kind of left to judge, aren't you? You're kind of left to judge, well, is this a respectable way to use a life or not?
Exactly. And there's, I mean, you said about that, Ian Hislop, creation about it, that it's a very funny book about some very sad men. And you kind of don't know whether Marcus Berkman is taking the piss out of himself or whether he isn't at some points when you read things, particularly about the cricket team they play for, the Scouts at Captain Scott 11, sounds like the biggest bunch of bastards. I mean, they all absolutely hate each other.
Yeah.
And you don't know whether Berkman really gets quite how weird the setup of his life in the summer really is altogether.
But it's odd, because I think you're right. There is a considerable extent to which he's taking the piss, really, that he's sort of insulting. But then there's the kind of the undercurrent of all this is he keeps going back, you know, week after week after week. You know, perhaps why this book worked, and I think it does basically work and was popular on release, was the fact that we are all, you know, a lot of us are in Berkman's position. We're big cricket fans and keen village cricketers. And that village cricket experience, Berkman does pin that. I mean, we all had our moments, I think, reading this book where we thought, we've seen that before.
Yeah, there's a fantastic, description of cricket teas in village pavilions. And just the fact is, you know, cricket teas are the great reversion to childhood. If there were jelly on the table, you can be sure it would be consumed with alacrity. Spiritual balloons hang from the wall, and sometimes you have to fight the overwhelming instinct to set up a game of pin the tail on the donkey. And it's funny, because these are all things we take for granted, but then you actually think about it, and there is something absolutely extraordinary about the village cricket tea, and the way that the whole ritual of it,
and for many players, in fact, I mean, I've been in this position, it becomes almost your raison d'être when you're out there on a Sunday and you've been fielding for 3 hours.
Exactly, and you're looking forward, and actually you get into the pavilion and your mood depends entirely on whether there's a good tea or not that's been prepared.
I think my kind of eureka moment reading this was when he talked of the cricketer who turns up and says, I can bowl a bit, and how that can either mean, you know, I once opened the bowling for a county, or I really, really can't bowl at all. And he's got a great eye for it. And I guess you could say that a lot of cricketers, village cricketers, could write a similar book. But it is that eye, it's that ability to pick up on those little details. He does make the international connections as well. And there's quite an engaging chapter where he talks about kind of how a lot of his cricketing heroes were the kind of unloved players. There's a rather wonderful bit on Chris Tavares, who he really, you know, eulogises. And I really relate to that.
Well, he's your kind of cricketer.
Well, exactly. I really relate to that. As someone who would always rather watch Shiv Chanderpool than anyone else, I really relate to this fact that cricket's often been a sport where the kind of...
You'd rather watch Tavares and Shiv Chanderpool, but boycott, you were in touch with the barge.
Oh, you know, a team with all three, I think that would be entertaining.
Would be the dream,
But, I mean, do you... if you're reading the book as a sort of a cricket fan, are you supposed to leave it feeling engaged by how wonderful the game is, or are you supposed to think, God, this is a ludicrous thing?
I found it quite sort of weirdly claustrophobic, actually, and a little bit deflating. So this summer I haven't unfortunately been able to play at all, and I usually do play throughout the summer. And I ended up at the end of finishing this thinking, do I actually want to start playing cricket again? So I don't know, it is very, very amusing, and it's very insightful and it's very witty. But there's just something so I think claustrophobic probably is the word about it.
He is good on, like, human nature as well. I mean, I think he shows how, you know, we look at professional sportsmen and then we get back to a sort of village side, and actually everyone wants to bowl. Everyone wants to bat first. You know, people... I loved his idea, and I'm sure I've encountered this, of moral umpiring.
So that if you're actually playing
very defensively, your teammates will give you out for the good of the team.
Yeah, exactly. And also, if you turn a bowler down for three appeals, then it's only fair to give the fourth one out.
Give the fourth one out.
Whether it's out or not.
No, it is certainly... I mean, I think we said this about quite a few of the books we read. It's got a very particular niche. I just wonder to what extent you know, someone who hasn't played the game, what they would make of this. Because I think it makes it sound almost cultish.
I think that's very true.
So if you want a slightly different perspective on village cricket, and a perspective on, frankly, being too obsessed with cricket generally, then give Rain Men by Marcus Berkman a go.
And so to the debate, and in the week when we hear that the ICC won't insist that that India use the DRS system, we ask whether the world's most powerful cricketing nation are right to hold up the forces of progress.
The point is, this isn't really just a debate about whether you think DRS is a good thing or not. It's a debate about the way world cricket is run, and the reality is, there is a consensus internationally that DRS is where Test cricket and actually one day cricket is going. It's part of the system. And the fact that one country continues to object to that is leading Test cricket in particular to look very odd. You have one series where we have DRS, one series where we don't. And that lack of consistency it's irritating as a viewer, but it's actually starting, I think, to compromise the integrity of the game, because a bowler is actually being able to get an LBW decision in England that they then can't get in India, for example. I think India has a right to an opinion. It's had a right, obviously, right to a stand on this issue. But I think that it's come to a point where they need to look at the landscape of the game. They need to look at the views of the other nations and accept that this has now been taken on board. I also have yet to see a really compelling case made against. I'm not sure what the objection is.
I've sort of got the short straw here, hasn't it? By the way, we tossed a coin to see who would argue which side of this debate, and I think I lost, because it's quite a difficult one to argue against. But what I would say...
Are you conceding the debate 10 seconds in?
I'm afraid I have. You've made your opening case, and I'm just gonna lie down and give up. No, but what I would say is that two things. Firstly, why is it that India object to the DRS, and they object to it because it's unreliable? And actually, we know that it is slightly unreliable. And that they're not rejecting it on principle. They're rejecting it in the way that some of the technology that is used and the unreliability of the technology that is used at the moment. Mm. And actually, this could be quite a useful chance. Rather than everyone adopting it straight away and it going through the mill, I take your point absolutely about consistency. But I think there's a chance here for people, you know, the whole thing to be reconsidered, and actually that India constantly raising objections in quite a high-profile way is quite a good way to do that. In terms of the fact that it needs to be consistent across the board, I agree with that, and it's kind of unfortunate that India have obviously thrown their weight around a little bit here. But I think that is kind of a wider problem with the ICC rather than necessarily a DRS-related problem, that actually there should be the ability for... It's strange that the ICC don't want to make DRS compulsory, because it shows two things. Firstly, that they're a little bit scared of their BCCI, but also that they don't have 100% confidence in it. Because if they were certain that it was a completely fair system and it was a completely good system, then there would be no reason why that they shouldn't ask other teams to opt in. And the problem is the basis on which the problem isn't the Indians opting out of it. It's the fact that in order for it to, that there is an opt-in system at all, I suppose.
Right. Okay. No, I mean, I take your point. Nobody disagrees with the fact that DRS is not perfect yet. I think it served its key function, which was always there, which was to get rid of the howlers, and it was to get rid of those decisions where a batsman is clearly, for example, the edge onto the LBW. Where I am concerned, and this is perhaps for a slightly different debate, but I think it's fair that some people raise concern about the fact that, for example, certain spinners are now picking up way more LBW decisions than they did, and it has slightly changed the nature of the game in that sense, and I don't think that's not what anyone wanted. DRS was supposed to aid rather than change the game.
But let's keep off the issue of whether DRS per se is a good thing, because I think I agree it's important, but I think it's a slightly separate issue. But I think with the situation with India is that they are saying this is having a seismic impact on the game, and this is something that they are not ready for. And that, because I mean, they're not stupid. They realise that the whole thing wouldn't just axe against them. That actually they would pick up some wickets that they didn't pick up before, and they would have some wickets against them that they wouldn't have before.
Where do you think this Indian opposition is rooted?
Well, I think that as someone who is myself sceptical about the whole idea of DRS, really, I think that actually that it's actually quite useful to have someone and a particularly strong player putting their hand up and saying, this is doing serious things to the game. It's really changing the game. Mm. Let's actually think about it properly. Because actually, there hasn't really, and partly because it's been this sort of opt-in thing rather than the ICC saying, right now, this is an across-the-board thing, there hasn't really been a proper debate and evaluation of the whole thing.
I wonder whether India have done enough to actually have that debate. I mean, I
but they can't have that debate by themselves. Otherwise, it would just be them stating
it. I have a feeling that you use the phrase, and I agree, they've thrown their weight around in this issue. And I'm not sure they've given enough justification for why they've done that. And as a result, I think you have ended up with what's basically been a case study of Indian dominance, and it's something that people feel uncomfortable with. You know, it's something people are uncomfortable with, the dominance of the IPL, and it's a part of cricket management, international cricket management, that's actually quite distressing for quite a lot of people involved. The fact that one country seems to have a certain stranglehold over whether certain decisions are made and certain decisions are taken. I mean,
can
you envisage a world in 10, 15 years' time in which DRS is not there?
No.
No.
Of course it will come in.
So we're talking effectively. I mean, you would accept that as someone who has your own concerns about the system, that there is an inevitability about this progression.
Yep.
So why not just get on with it?
There's an inevitability about a lot of things that, yes, it's inevitably going to happen, but I don't think it's a bad thing to actually be able to stop and take stock and do it at a more considered pace. And I think the problem isn't... It depends what you think comes first. Whether you think that the ICC deciding it has to happen on an opt-in, opt-out basis, a voluntary basis, comes first, or whether the Indians raising objections to it comes first, and therefore the ICC say, okay, the way we're going to get around it is for it to be opt-in, opt-out. And the difference, I suppose, the point is that I don't know whether, I mean, I'm sure, I'm not naive enough to say if it was Bangladesh that the situation would be exactly the same.
Yeah.
Of course it wouldn't. But I do think that as long as the ICC are using it on this opt-in basis, then the Indians actually have every right to say, no, we're not comfortable with it, so we're not going to go with it.
I think it's certainly going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, because I think it's going to continue to be an issue, and it's continued to be quite an issue for the players who go from one series to the next with the rules slightly changing. Thanks for listening to the 33rd episode of Restaurant Radio. We hope to be back with you in a couple of weeks' time.